Can I encourage you to turn to Ezra 10 as we tackle this together? I've entitled this tonight, The People Confess. The People Confess. And Ezra's distress at the sin of this intermarriage, marrying people from these other nations, had a great impact on the people, and it speaks there of a great crowd that gather and weep with him. And as we look at this, the first thing we see is the call to arise in verses 1 to 5. And certainly in verse 1, the situation is very sad. It's very discouraging. It says, while Ezra prayed and made confession, weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, a very great assembly of men, women, and children gathered to him out of Israel, for the people wept bitterly. What a very sad picture. There's Ezra falling down in front of the temple. He's weeping, he's crying out, and the people, men, women, and children, join with him. They became aware of their sin. This is a great work of the Spirit of God, convicting these people of their sin and the seriousness of what they have done. But then this man called Shechaniah takes the lead. And while he continues to recognize the seriousness of the situation, he speaks in verse 2 with hope. He says there, we have broken faith of our God and have married foreign women from the peoples of the land. But even now there is hope for Israel in spite of this. Now, Shechaniah, his name means intimate with God. What a great name. And what a lesson there is even in his name. A man who speaks hope and brings hope into that very sad situation is a man who is described as being intimate with God. And if we are going to be people who bring hope into our families, hope into our communities, hope into our classrooms, hope into our workplace, hope into where we live, we are to be a people who are intimate with God. Because it's people who know their God well, who will be people who will be able to bring the most hope into very challenging and needy situations. And Shechaniah calls here for the people to enter into a covenant with the Lord, to show their seriousness and their real desire to repent. In verse 3, he says that. And probably what was encouraging him was Deuteronomy chapter 30 and verses 8 to 10. It's a passage about being restored to the land after the people would be in exile. Now, this was given to them before they'd even entered the promised land. And God knew what was ahead. And through Moses, he's telling them, if you've turned away and have sinned, I'll send you into the different nations. But if you turn back to me, I'll bring you back. And it continues in speaking from there. And we're going to read you part of it now. It says this, and you shall again obey the voice of the Lord and keep all his commandments that I command you today. The Lord your God will make you abundantly prosperous in all the work of your hand, in the fruit of your womb, and in the fruit of your cattle, and in the fruit of your ground. For the Lord will again take delight in prospering you, as he took delight in your fathers. When you obey the voice of the Lord your God to keep his commandments and the statutes that are written in this book of law, when you turn to the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul. And Shechaniah is saying, yes, our situation is bad. Yes, we have done a terrible thing. But do you remember the lovely promises of God? Do you realize what is the nature of God? He is a God, yes, of holiness. He's a God of justice. But he is this God of love and forgiveness. He's a God who delights to restore those who have gone astray. And we see next that Ezra is called to arise. Shechaniah is given Ezra his place as leader. And Shechaniah promises that he will support him. If you look there at verse 4, he says that, arise, for it is your task, and we are with you. Be strong and do it. Oh, what a price could you put on such support like that? Go for it, Ezra. This is tough. You do the right thing, and we are right behind you. I remember when I was an assistant in Wellington Street, I was interviewed for a church, which will remain nameless. And I was aware as a church which had quite a number of significant problems. There had been real issues that really, I think in the end, caused the previous minister to leave because he had had enough of these problems. And I was aware of these issues. I was aware of the situation. And I remember speaking to the elders and said, listen, in dealing with situations, will you be supportive to me? And well, the answer was, well, if we think we agree with you. The next day I pulled out of that and didn't go any further because I thought, I'm not going to go in a situation where they're not going to support me. I remember another situation. I was quite early on in my ministry. I had a difficult session meeting. There was an issue arose, and it was tough. And it was the first maybe very difficult session meeting I'd had as a minister. And there was an elderly gentleman, one of the elders, as he was walking out the door, and he was a farmer, and he had hands like a shovel. And he just shook my hand with those big hands. And a big smile on his face. And all he said was two words. Good man. And just having people who support you, people who know you're seeking to do the Lord's will, who will encourage you, that is vital. I value that. I know people are supportive. I hope you're supportive to your elders. I hope you're supportive to our organization leaders. They need to be encouraged. They need to be supported in what they're doing. They need to know that you're with them. It's good to ask them and how things are going, and even at times to offer to give some practical support. Leading a family, leading a church, and in Ezra's case, leading a nation out of sin is a great challenge. It needs tremendous courage. If you look back at the men of the Reformation, people like Martin Luther, John Calvin, John Knox, they probably weren't the people you would invite for a nice wee tea party. In some senses, they mightn't have been the best of company. These were strong and tough men. And the work of reformation is hard. People hold on to their sin very closely. And we must be strong. If you want to see your family changed, if you don't want your family to walk in godless ways in the future, if you want to see your church, your community, it takes great determination. The battle's not easy. Think of how Ezekiel was told by the Lord will make his head like flint. So hard. Yes, we should be gracious. We should be merciful. We should be kind. But boy, we need to be determined to see God's will done. So the people we see here in verse 5, they're led by the priests and the Levites. Remember, they were singled out for leading the people astray. We're thinking about that this morning. Now they lead the people in the right way. And they respond with an oath that they will do this. They will do what is right. So there we have the call to arise. And then secondly, we have the call to assemble in verses 6 to 8. The people are given 3 days to assemble or be cut off. There is no place for merely private religion or merely private worship among the people here. They couldn't just say, well, I have my own personal faith and I'll just keep to myself. No, it had to be corporate. It had to be part of God's people. They had to be one with God's people. They had to identify with God's people. And people who are unwilling to do that, there's a big, big problem. They're out of step of what it means to be part of God's people. They're out of step of what it means to be part of the church. The word church means ecclesia, the called out ones, people who are called out to stand for Christ. And we need to stand together. And people who wouldn't stand were going to be cut off. People who refused to come and to assemble within 3 days, they were going to be cut off. Their land was going to be forfeited. Because this was such a desperate situation. The whole future of the holy people of God was at stake here. If this matter was not sorted out, God's people would not survive. The people from whom the Messiah was to come would not survive. And so the people had to be really serious about this. We see in verse 6 that Ezra, he quietly goes to the chamber of a man called Jehohanan. He spends the night neither eating bread nor drinking water. He was mourning, but I'm sure he was just praying for God's help, because it's only God could turn these people around. What was being asked of people was an amazing thing, and only God would enable him to do it. And so he goes to be alone with the Lord and seeking grace before coming to the assembly. And then we have the call to separate in verses 9 to 11. I think the verse there, verse 9, is very interesting. It says, "And all the people sat in the open square before the house of God, trembling because of this matter and because of the heavy rain." They were meeting in the middle of December. That's, we're told, the date of it there, in the ninth month. Their year starts end of March, April. So it's the middle of December, the coldest part of the year, the rainy season in Israel. And there they were sitting before the temple in Jerusalem in the middle of this rain. So because of the rain, but also because of the heaviness of the situation, the people were shaking. It reminds me of the situation in the time of the revival, 1859, and that Monday night communion thanksgiving service in First O'Hockle. And they couldn't stay in the building, such a crowd, and they went out into the rain, and they stood in the rain. Such was their hunger for God. And we see here among these people, there was a seriousness. Nothing was going to put them off. If you think today, what puts people off from coming to church, what puts people off from coming to a prayer meeting or a Bible study, it's absolutely horrendous how easily people are put off. These people were prepared to sit in the rain in the middle of December. They were shaking because of that and because of the seriousness of the matter. And we see the crux of the matter in verse 11. "Now then, make confession to the Lord, the God of your fathers, and do his will. Separate yourselves from the peoples of the land and from the foreign wives." What a horrendous thing for husbands to be asked to do. And the children were included in this, it says elsewhere. Now, these men, probably most of them, loved their wives. They loved their children. They're being asked by God, "If you love me, you need to send your wives and your children away." It just reminds me what Jesus says, "If you love father or mother more than me, you're not worthy to be my disciple." And you know, if you were writing this story, if you're writing about this situation and about what should be done here, I don't think there's many of us would have said all the wives and the children need to be put away. I don't think any of us would say that. We would qualify it up. No. There's a family. We don't want to break up this family. Families are so important. How could that happen? This was a horrendous prospect. I don't think I can get right words to say what a dreadful thing for these people to do. But this shows the seriousness of their sin. This was a situation that was so bad, the future of the people of God depended on them doing this at this time. This was really, really a drastic situation. It's a situation in many ways like no other which the people of God had faced. And you know, we need to be aware of the seriousness of sin. We need to be aware that sin in our lives, sin in the life of our community as a church family, it needs to be dealt with. Think of the words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 5. "You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, turn it out and throw it away. For it's better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it's better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German pastor and theologian during the time of the Second World War. In the end, he was executed because of his opposition to Hitler. He has written a book called The Cost of Discipleship, and he speaks about this passage. And he says, you know, we have to be careful that we don't just qualify it away. In other words, we have to realize that the Lord is calling for drastic action in our lives. He's talking about cutting out your eye. Now, of course, he doesn't mean us to do that literally, because if you're looking at someone lustfully with two eyes, if you've cut one out, you still can do it in that. But what he is saying is, deal with the problem. Deal with the problem before it takes you down to hell. Sin is something horrendous. Sin is something that's dreadful. I was watching a wee bit last night, only we flicked it on, a wee bit of film, Jack Reacher. And to be honest, I watched about 2 minutes of it, and I had to flick it over because there's a man there, very scary character, who had been in Siberia, and he survived by not going down the sulfur mines by biting off his fingers so that he wouldn't be sent down the mines, and that's how he survived. He bit off his own fingers, and this man, he was telling him to do the same, and that's the point that I turned over, had enough of it. I didn't want to see what I was going to have next, but that's what he was challenged to. Show me how serious you are to survive. Bite off your fingers. Jesus is saying something serious, similar here. I don't know what other language he could use to get across as that sin is so serious, and we can't play with it. And that's the message of Ezra, of the casting away of these foreign wives. Sin is so serious and can't be played with. Brings us to our next point, which is the call for a plan in verses 12 to 15. The people agree to obey, but they ask for it to happen over a period of time. Listen, we're in the middle of the rainy season here. We're cold and wet here. And the problem is so deep, we just can't deal with this problem today. Get people to deal with it around the cities and towns over these next few months. And I just think there's a great wisdom there. I think of the people just there and then says, we'll do this. And the emotion of the moment, it mightn't have lasted. And see, dealing with sin and dealing with the problems we face in life, just an emotional reaction is not enough. We have to think and plan about how we deal with sin in our lives. If there are certain things which are hindering your spiritual growth, certain things that are leading you astray, you need to think about it and plan indeed how that will be dealt with. And if you have a good confidant, a husband or wife, or someone else you're close to, talk to them about that, if there's some sin in your life that needs to be dealt with. Rico Tice has a really good friend, and they're accountable to each other. And you know, note the one question when they come together, they ask. What is the one question you do not want me to ask you? What's the one question you don't want me to ask you? In other words, what is it that needs to be dealt with? The people have this plan. They agree to it. We see in verse 15, there are only four, which is amazing, only four who stood against it. But the rest of the people said, okay, let this be done over the next period. And then we come to the final point, which is the call is obeyed from verse 16 to the end. This plan of working city by city, town by town, meant there was a thoroughness which can be seen in the record from verse 18 to the end of the chapter of all the people whose wives and children were sent away. It's interesting, among those listed included the sons of Jeshua, the high priest, who back in chapter 3 was a great leader in the rebuilding of the temple. This just shows how deep sin can run, and sin will be a problem in any family. and we all need God's grace. So the whole matter took 3 months to deal with. But what do we make of this? What do we make of this? Is God right in asking them to do this? Why is God doing this? A. E. Condell, this great quote I came across. The unhappiness caused by these broken homes must be set not only against the initial transgression involved in the contracting of the marriages, but also against the ultimate blessing to the whole world that could come only through a purified community. The blessing that would come to the whole world only through a purified community. In many ways, this was a one-off. This was such a terrible situation. If this sin had not been dealt with, if these ungodly influences had remained with them, they would have been wiped out in no time because of that sinful influence. They would have ceased to be the holy people of God, a special people that God was keeping for himself and planning for his son to be born from. And that's the big issue here. That God's plan of salvation was at stake here. God's plan to bring salvation to the whole world depended on these people being sorted out and coming back to be a pure and holy treasured possession for the Lord. Purity is so crucial if we want to know God's blessing. Purity is so crucial if we are going to have a part in bringing salvation to our community, to our land. And tough decisions have to be made at times in order to walk that path of cleanness. Now, what is the application for us today? How do we apply that for us today? Well, let me just talk to any who are believers who have unsaved husbands. The question to be asked, should believers get rid of their unsaved spouses? Husbands or wives? Well, I'm glad to say Paul says definitely no. Some in his day were saying you should. People who became Christians and who had unsaved husbands or wives, he's saying get rid of them, leave them, divorce them. That's what these super spiritual people were saying in Corinth. This is Paul's response. 1 Corinthians 7, verses 12 to 16. He says, to the rest I say, I, not the Lord. Now, don't take too much of that. He had quoted from the Lord earlier, so he's still speaking with the authority of the Lord. So it still comes with apostolic authority. That if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For, and listen to this, the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife. And the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Now, he's not saying there that the husband is automatically saved because of his Christian wife, or the wife is automatically saved because of her Christian husband. But they're holy. They're set apart. There's a holy and godly influence in them. And God looks upon them differently because of their saved spouse. Otherwise, your children would be unclean. But as it is, they are holy. The children of a home where there's at least one Christian, they're set apart in God's eyes. They're seen as being different. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you'll save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? And he's saying here, like, this should be really encouraging for Christian wives and Christian husbands whose spouses are not saved yet. What a wonderful truth. They're made holy. You're praying for them. You're living with them. You're putting your godly influence into their lives. You should really expect that by God's grace, they'll be drawn to Jesus for salvation. Pray for that. Think of how he says in Peter says about wives winning their husbands over without words as they see their godly lives. So remember what we have here in Ezra. It's a one-off situation, not to be repeated. Come to the New Testament, Paul is saying, wives, stick in there with your unsaved husband. It's hard at times, I know, stick in there. Husbands, stick in there with your unsaved wives. You're having an influence on them more than you ever imagine. What an encouraging truth is. Paul teaches for situations where there is an unbelieving couple and one gets saved. That's what he's talking about. He's not saying here that, listen, as we said this morning, that a Christian should be free to marry a non-saved person and automatically expect to be saved because they're going against God's commandment. And yet God is more gracious than we ever deserve. He's talking about the situation of two unsaved people and then one gets converted. But as a church, what's the application for us today from Ezra here? Well, surely it has to mean the putting away of any sin that would hinder us. That could include immorality in our midst, idolatry, worshiping the things of this world before God, bitterness, pride, jealousy, gossip, greed, worldliness, lukewarmness. We need to put away anything that hinders our devotion to Christ. Do you remember how indeed writing to the churches in Asia that indeed the Lord warned them that they could lose their lampstand? If they weren't careful and turned from their sinful ways, they could lose their witness. They could cease to be a church. In Ezra's day, the church's survival depended on them putting away sin. The church today, Brookside Church, whatever church you belong to, its future depends on putting away sin. And if we turn to the Lord who is strong and kind, if we come back to him and plead for his grace to make us a holy and pure people, if we're really committed to that, if we're really devoted to that, he will pour blessing upon us in the days ahead. I was reading this past week in my own devotions, the book of Joshua and Achan's sin. You remember that story, Joshua 7? They come and they attack Jericho and they're told to devote everything to the Lord. And Achan spies some nice goodies, which he takes and hides in his tent. They go to attack the city of Ai. 36 or so men are killed in that battle because of his sin. If there's sin in the camp, the blessing from heaven stops. Each of us need to examine our hearts, examine our life, realize the seriousness of sin, repent of it, and seek God's grace to overcome it in our lives. Amen.